mainland tomorrow. That's as the trough slowly moves further east. Then a cold front crossing New South Wales during Friday and Saturday will combine with a high behind it to draw some very cold and dry air into the state. Obviously, frost making a return. That front can move through Adelaide, introducing showers and possible small hail, rain showers.
Good evening, everyone. We're going to be starting in a few minutes. We'll start in 1 minute, roughly. Okay, I think we'll make a start. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this one-off session called Testing the Strength of Your Relationship. We don't normally do stuff on Thursday night this way, but I figured people are sort of at home now, stay-at-home orders. So we can turn it into an opportunity. People are home more. So I thought it'd be good to get together, learn a little bit, and use the time, use the situation, so to speak, to pause and reflect a little bit more. So the topic for tonight, which is testing the strength of the relationships, is not a lockdown topic necessarily, because it's something that's always needed. All relationships need nurturing and strengthening. Any relationship is, it doesn't matter what kind of relationship it is. It could be marriage, it could be something very close, something not so close, friends, employers, employees. Any relationship that's going to last and have meaning is certainly always needs work and always needs reflection and always needs review, so to speak, and certainly a lot of nurturing. But of course, when we're in a more of a tough situation, like in a lockdown type situation, it does add a little bit of extra anxiety, a feeling perhaps of being unsettled, people a bit more stressed out and feeling the strain. So yes, that could also be a factor that puts a little bit of pressure on relationships, especially close relationships, and therefore it's even more important of a topic. Now, of course, what I'm going to share with you tonight is just a one-off thought. It's a formula, it's an idea. Relationships is a huge topic. It's not something one does in a little bit of a 45-minute session or whatever the case is. But I thought that given the time of the year that we're in the Jewish calendar, which I'm going to explain in a moment, I want to share with you a model, just a kind of a model just to think about. And I suppose the purpose of that model is not that that's the be-all and end-all formula, but it's a model just to reflect on and to use as a to spark discussion or to spark reflection. to refer back to, sort of as a formula. And it's an idea based on mysticism, on a mystical idea to do with the time of the year that we're in. So let me give you a bit of context first before we get to the practical relationship application. So at the moment in the Jewish calendar, we're in a period known as the 3 weeks, Ben Amtzarim, which is a period of sadness, a period of mourning, actually. And it's a period leading up to the saddest day of the year, which is this Sunday, 2 weeks from this coming Sunday, known as Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. And it's the day that we mourn the destruction of both temples. We're talking about the temples that stood in Jerusalem between the years of 833 before the Common Era BCE and the year 69 when the second temple was destroyed. So the first temple was this amazing edifice that stood in Jerusalem for 410 years, 70 years, and then it was destroyed by the Babylonians 70 years later. The second temple was built and that stood for 420 years and was subsequently destroyed in the year 69 by the Romans. Now, the temples were physical edifices. They were the place where the presence of God was apparent and obvious. It was a place where God's sort of presence could be felt, an extra spiritual and divine consciousness, and so on and so forth. But Kabbalistically, we learn that the Beit HaMikdash, the temples that we remember, especially during this time of the year, was not just an edifice, wasn't just a physical building, but it was more of a model. It was built in a way that symbolized and represented a model of a relationship, first of all, between us and God, but by extension, between us and others. Because we know them from our commentaries, we know from the Torah, that relationships are all connected, including the relationships that we have with people and the relationships we have with God. Because as Jews, we don't just follow God, we're supposed to have a relationship with Him. And in fact, we are taught that in the Chumash, in the Torah, before the Jews stand at Mount Sinai and become God's nation, the stories in the Bible, the stories in the Torah, are very much about human relationships. Because the truth is that if we can have healthy relationships with other people, it goes together, we can have healthy relationships with God, and vice versa. Because as we'll see, a relationship is really about making room for the other, or having the ability to connect, learn, and make room for the other, and explore the other's greatness, and learn and grow from the other. And therefore, relationships with God, relationships with people are all connected. And the temple was a model of relationship. And therefore, even though the temple is destroyed, we pray for its return and rebuilding. That's part of the Jewish prayers. But we still have the spiritual temple. We still need to learn from the structure of the temple in terms of how it serves as a model for ourselves. So to share with you this idea of how this relates to relationships, I need to spend a few moments, just bear with me. By the way, the chat is open. If anyone wants to make a comment or ask a question, please feel free to put it in the chat and I'll definitely try and get to it. But what I need to do first is just to give you a little bit of a crash course in what the temple looked like. Not its details and its trimmings and so on, but the basic structure of the temple. I need to give you a quick crash course of what it looked like and then explain to you Kabbalistically how that translates into the human function and how that translates into the way we have relationships. So in order to do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually share with you a picture. I'm going to share the screen for a moment. There's just a floor plan of the temple. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details, all the little chambers and rooms. I'm just going to share with you the basics. And again, bear with me because this is just going to serve as the basis for the concept that I want to really share with you. So Maimonides actually explains this at great length. The essence of the structure of the temple divided itself into three parts. There was this part over here, if you will follow my mouse, where it says the number 66, that was the holiest part of the temple, known as the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. In this little room, which was in a building with a roof, this little room housed the Ark. The Ark had in it a Torah scroll and the Ten Commandments that were given to the Jewish people in the desert. And that was the holiest spot of the temple. People didn't go there normally. It was just a place of holiness. Once a year in Yom Kippur, the high priest would go there representing the Jewish nation. But although it wasn't sort of, it was in the background behind the scenes and it was the place of great holiness, it was the essence and it was the core and it was the foundation of the rest of the temple. So that was the first area, area number one of the temple. The second was this area over here, where you see the numbers 62, 63, 59, and so on. This area was known as the Kodesh. It was one step down. And this chamber, this room, so to speak, also part of the building structure with the roof and everything, this housed three important vessels, three important items in the temple. The candelabra, the menorah, the small altar, which was used for incense, and the shulchan, the table, where they would place on it the showbreads. Now, I'm not going to go into tonight the intricacies of these different vessels, just suffice to say that it was three vessels, one on either side of the one in the north, one in the south, and one sort of more the east in the middle. So three vessels. Now, these two rooms, room number one, the holy, and room number two, the holy of holies, the holiest spot, and number two, the second room, which has these three holy items. This was all in a building which had a roof. It was inside the building, so to speak, right? Outside, then you go outside, right? I mean, don't worry about all the details. I'm just giving you the basic outline here. Then there was the third spot, the third area of the temple, which was known as the Azara, the courtyard. And the courtyard, interestingly enough, is where most of the activities of the temple took place. So the daily sacrifices, the daily rituals, which comprised a lot of different forms of sacrifice. There were animal sacrifices, there were bird sacrifices, there were flower offerings, libations on the altar, all these different forms of sacrifice, and the singing of the Levites and all that stuff. A lot of the activity actually took place in the courtyard, which didn't have a roof. It was outside, known as the outside area, and that was where it took place. So these are the three areas. The three areas are the small room called the Holy of Holies, which housed the Ark and the Ten Commandments, the larger inside room, which housed three holy objects, and then the outside courtyard, which has the big altar, where the main activity, sacrificial activity, took place every single day. Busy activity, there was a busy routine that took place every day during the temple times. Okay, now, Kabbalah teaches us that actually that layout was actually a model for a healthy human function. Because we are taught in Jewish sources that a healthy human being, in the way a human being he or she relates to himself or herself, and the way they relate to others, the way we function, the way we respond to the world around us, the way we grow as human beings, the way we develop, we divide it into three layers. Things we've talked about before, but I want to put in the context of understanding the temple. So, and these are governing forces of human function. The first thing, I'm talking about in a human consciousness. I'm not talking about now the subconscious and what goes on behind the scenes and the depth of subconsciousness of the human being and so on, which is all real and all very important as well. I'm talking about now the way we function consciously on a functional day-to-day level. The first thing we have is the concept of the brain, the ability to be objective, the ability to make decisions, the ability to choose, the ability to be educated, to understand right from wrong, good over evil, read the environment around us, understand what is good for us, what is bad for us, what is spiritual for us, what is not spiritual for us, and so on and so forth. That is all comes from the choice that we have as human beings, and the choice, of course, consciously rests in the brain, rests in the power of intellect, the power of cognition, which is the first part of the human being. And in fact, a healthy human being is one that is able to make decisions based on objectivity. What sets us apart from animals, for example, is that we're not supposed to be impulsive. What is now the basis of so much of modern psychology, particularly positive psychology, CBT, Stephen Covey's stuff, Viktor Frankl, more recently the choice by Edith Eger and so on and so forth, is the concept which is already written many, many hundreds of years ago in Hasidic teachings and in Kabbalistic teachings, the concept that Moach Shalit al Halev, the brain rules the heart, which means that we have the ability to use the words of Stephen Covey to pause when we have a stimulus, which is triggering a response, that we don't respond impulsively, we don't just jump into it, but we actually make a calculated decision. We're able to take a step back. We're able to pause. We're able to, in our brains, objectively look at the thing. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it evil? Is it bad? Is it spiritual, not spiritual? Is it constructive? Is it destructive? And then make a decision and channel and control our emotional response to be beneficial in the long-term sense, that is good for us both physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So that's the foundation of the human consciousness, or it should be at least, the power to think, the power to think things through and to make decisions in a proper, thought-out, value-based way. But of course, the second part of human function is emotion, feeling, passion. It is not healthy. It is not good to live a life purely by the brain. We need to, in fact, the personality of the person actually does not live in the brain. The personality of the person lives in the heart, as the Talmud says. In other words, you can tell the person, you cannot really tell the personality of a human being from the way they think, or the way they, because we can think all sorts of things. We can think objectively. I can lecture and I can talk about things which might be completely opposite to my personality. But a person is you can notice what a person, who a person is, what their personality is, by the things that they're passionate about, by their feelings, by their love, by their hate, what they love, what they hate, what they reject, what they embrace. If they're jealous, if they're not jealous, if they get angry, they don't get angry, if they hate, they don't hate, they take revenge, they don't take revenge, all these things, right? All these things are a set of emotions, all rooted in what Kabbalah calls the six layers of emotion, starting from Chesed and Gevurah and Tiferet, all the things we've talked about many, many times, right? These are the sort of, this plays a critical role. Because although we say that a human being should not be led by the heart, in other words, a human being should not be impulsive like an animal and be animalistic, that we just impulsively react with our natural instinct, which might be good for us, which might be bad for us in an animalistic way, but we need to think things through and channel our emotions through the guidance of the head. True. On the other hand, however, we dare not live our life by killing emotion. We talk about guiding because emotions play a critical role. Passion is the basis of successful human function. Excitement, enthusiasm, engagement, which is emotional really, is the basis of success in so many different areas of life, particularly in the area of relationships. So therefore the second room, the second part of the inner temple, so to speak, is the emotion. Then of course comes the third part, the activity, the application of all of that. We can think things through, we can get excited about things, we can have the right expression of emotion, and yet we're unable to apply it when faced with a practical situation. Put it into practice, make sure it works on the most physical and tangible context. So that's how the Kabbalists explain the layout of the temple. So the innermost chamber, the Holy of Holies, which housed the Ten Commandments, is representative of the brain. That's what the education, that's why the Torah was there. The Torah scroll and the Ten Commandments, that's the values. That's the things that guide, that we think about, that we work through. That's what the basis of a human being is. It starts from the healthy process of building a set of good values through education, through understanding, through working things out, through learning about what is good and bad, through learning about what is the right thing and the wrong thing, right? All of that starts in the brain. All of that starts with our value system, which from a Jewish perspective, it obviously is guided by the Torah, by the ethics, by the ethical teachings, by the morality that we are taught and inspired by the Torah's teachings. So that's where the Ark is. The Ark is in the Holy of Holies. It's the essence, it's the foundation of human function. And then, of course, we have the emotion, which is the next room. Now, that room, as we said before, has three holy objects. And the connection mystically to our emotional structure is, because although we have six emotions, but we've talked about this many times, in fact, Kabbalistically, the main driving force of, and we'll talk about this a bit more later, exactly what it means, but the main driving force of our of the emotional structure, of the way we function, is the three primary emotions, the three primary categories of emotion, shall we say, known in Kabbalah as Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet. And then, of course, we have the outside. The outside represents the reason why the most of the activity of the temple took place outside, because the outside represents when we go out of ourselves. All that we think about, all that we feel, is all within ourselves before we face the world, before we face that which is beyond us. But as soon as we go out of ourselves, we have to contend, we have to engage with distractions, with things that threaten us, with things that undermine us, with things that make it difficult, the obstacles of life and so on and so forth. That's the outside distraction. That's when it becomes more difficult to apply what we've thought through and what we become excited about. And therefore, we need them to have that strength to actually put it into practice, to communicate it to the outside world and to put it into practice and to live by that which we understand and by that which we feel. And that's the harder part. And that's why that's where the main activity of the human being takes place. And that's why it's not considered the inside, it's considered outside, because it's when we relate to what is outside of us. So that's the concept, that's the idea. So let me try and relate this now to the concept of relationships. Relationships are complicated things, as we know. Two different people relate to each other. It is also at the very heart and core and essence of human experience. In the entire day, we are engaged in relationships, all types of relationships. Those that are less close, those that are more close. We know that the essence of the human being is relationships. When Adam and Eve were created, Adam was created, and God said, it is not good for people to be alone. It is not good for man to be alone. I will make him an Ezer Kenegdol. I will create a relationship for him. Because the essence of the human being is relationships. It's through relationships that we grow. And in fact, it's precisely the difficulty of relationships that makes us grow. What I mean by that is, the reason that relationships is so the essence of what it is to be human is because what it is to be human is to grow, is to go beyond ourselves, is to not be trapped in our own personality, in our own paradigm, in our own little box. But the essence of the human being is the ability to grow beyond who we are, to nurture our strengths, and to be able to go beyond the obstacles that stand within us and not to box ourselves in. As we know, we are not bound by our personality. We're not bound by our weaknesses. We are able to grow. We are able to embrace that which we don't have a natural disposition to, right? That is, so that's something we've talked about a lot. That's the essence of the human being. And we achieve that through relationships. That's how we achieve it. Because when two people come together, and by definition, there are no two people that think and see the world in exactly the same way, and that's a good thing. Relationships have differences, and we grow from those differences if we embrace the relationships correctly. But the relationship success needs a formula. It needs a formula. And that formula is very much the structure of the temple that I just shared with you. Now, it is true. Let me try and develop this a little bit. It is true that in a relationship, what nurtures the relationship more than anything is emotion, not intellect. What nurtures the relationship is what keeps it together, closeness, love, the glue of relationships must come strongly from the heart, obviously. People who enter in relationships and only in relationships with the head, it's a very cold and boring relationship. Relationships must function through the heart. The passion, the glue, the excitement, the nurturing, the growth of a relationship needs to come from the heart. But here's the mistake people often make. It must come from the heart, but it must be guided by the head. And people often forget, before they are ready to get into serious relationships, to actually spend time thinking, to reflect on what they need to know and what they need to understand and what they need to process through the power of cognition to make the relationships work. And that includes lots of different things. first of all, includes an examination of one's own values. It is important before one enters into serious relationships to actually reflect, what are my values? What type of life do I want to live? What are my goals? What are my long-term goals? Why do I want a relationship? Why? Why do I want to enter relationships? Is it selfish? Is it because I want pleasure? Is it because I want something that's going to be good for me? Or do I want to grow? Is it something I want to enter into a context where I can imply selflessness? I can put value into the relationship. I can learn from somewhere else. I'm able to embrace another perspective, another world, another worldview, and learn from that and embrace it and give and take so that I can grow. What's the purpose? In other words, have I thought about this? Right. Have I thought about what my goals are? And is that going to work in this relationship? People often don't also give thought to how ready they are for relationships, right? People give a lot of thought to, how do I know this relationship is going to work? But often that's not, you know, a lot of you have heard me say this many times. It's not about is this relationship for me? People are often very, very slow to commit to relationships because they're not 100% sure, is it going to work? And the real answer is, it's not about, is it going to work? It's not about, is this the person for me? It's about also, am I ready to put in the work? Am I ready to respect? Am I ready to embrace a different view? Right. And then there comes the whole concept, you know, is this person that I want to, it might seem like amazing. It might seem very romantic. It might seem like it's a lot of fun. It might seem like this is just a passionate relationship. But did I give thought to it a little bit before? Is it a compatible relationship on some level? Now, when I say compatible, I don't mean similar interests and similar viewpoints, because that's a boring relationship. The greatness, the depth of the relationship is, you know, I always say that we enter into relationships because of sameness, but the depth of relationships is revealed through difference, not through sameness. Yet at the same time, one does have to give some thought to common values, right? Because in a very close relationship, like marriage, for example, common values are important. They're not always there, and sometimes we can get around it, but common values are important. The way we express those values, the way we implement those values are very different. So all this needs thought, all this needs reflection, all this needs to be worked through. People grow and they work it through and they think about it, or they should think about it. And it's also about, am I ready to respect? Am I wrapped up in myself, or am I ready to go out of myself? Am I ready to respect a different perspective? I might share values with someone, but there's going to be so much different of how you express those values, how a household runs, how a relationship runs, how we do things, how we implement things. There's so many differences. Am I ready to entertain a difference between us, right? So I just want to also just pause a minute and talk about compatibility of values. Because some relationships, compatible values are very important, but some of them, they're not so important. Because there's different types of relationships. I always talk about that in marriage, for example, a very close relationship. Common values are important. It makes things a lot easier because that's how we run the home. The differences are more in the way we do things, the way we express those values. And that's what we need to learn, to respect each other's values. But the truth is that it's not just that. The truth is that in many, many other relationships, it might be work relationships, it might be family relationships, cousins, families, right? Where people have a different value system. And even there, we need to be able to be respectful people, able to entertain and to embrace other values, even if we totally disagree with them. And that's something I pause and I'm emphasizing that because we live in a world today where that is just almost gone, that whole concept. Because I think it comes from a just totally egocentric world. You know, I'll tell you what I mean. I'll give you an example. I read this, you know, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, I was doing a bit of reading the Supreme Justice on the U.S. court. I was doing a bit of reading, and one thing that inspired me, and I'm not going into her views and her political views or political biases, that's not relevant to this discussion at all, but one thing that inspired me tremendously is her relationship with a colleague that she had, Justice Scalia. and they became very, very good friends. They were very deep friends and actually got on tremendously, even though they were on two opposite sides of the political spectrum and the understanding of the legal process. I saw a video of Justice Scalia talking about it. He says he really likes Justice Ginsburg. He likes everything about her except anything to do with law. He just disagrees with her on everything to do with law. And yet they were great friends. And that kind of model is actually almost disappeared today. It's really sad. It's unbelievably sad, where people can disagree with people, deeply disagree with people, completely think they're wrong, which is okay. I mean, sometimes if it's not a deep conviction, we don't need to think other people are wrong. We just need to think this is where we see the world and this is where they see the world. And the way they see the world perhaps is an alternative truth. But even if we don't think so, even if we think the other person is totally wrong. I mean, it's unbelievable. For example, I mean, it's not so much in Australia, but in America, for example, in the recent few years, in the completely polarized political system, you have family fights, family breakdowns, because people are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, which is unbelievably sad. And I just thought when I read that, it was so inspiring, because they're just one was left, one was right, one was originalist, one wasn't. And just yet they had such respect for each other, because that's what relationships are. And all these things happen not in the heart, because in the heart we get passionate. Once we're in the heart, once we're only in the heart, we're passionate about who we are. So therefore, before relationships can actually thrive, we need that holy of holies. We need that holy room of thought, of education, of values, of selflessness, but thinking through that even though I might be a certain way, even though my emotions, my impulses, my instincts direct me in a particular way, but I need to be able to control that through the power of cognition, through the power of thinking, into a channeled, guided, and respectful process. So therefore, the basis of a relationship, and it's a hidden way room, it's a foundation, it's not a room which was visited that often, because that's not that the relationship doesn't thrive in the head, but it needs to be guided by the head. So that's part one. And even if we're in a relationship, every so often we need to take time off and think about how we're doing in our relationship. Are we being respectful? Are we growing from the other? Are we giving and taking? Are we being selfish or selfless? Are we being egocentric, or are we being humble? And so on and so forth. So the head is a foundation, and it's a foundation, a beacon of guidance, and it plays a very critical role in the process of relationships. But then, of course, we go to the world of emotion. And the world of emotion is critical in relationships. It's passion, it's excitement, it's love, it's connection, it's engagement. And that's where really a relationship thrives. And we know that, as I said before, there are three primary emotions. And this is where often people don't really process exactly what it takes emotionally to have a thriving, successful relationship. Because we know that in our emotional responses to the outside world, there are two primary emotions known in Kabbalah as Chesed and Gevurah, which are synthesized and come together by the third one called Tiferet. And this is represented by those three holy objects in that second room, the emotional structure of the human being. Because we often think, let's say in very close relationships, we often look at relationships and we often think that what will make a relationship thrive is love. And of course, love is critical. And love is the glue of relationships. But as we've talked about many, many times, we need to have selfless love, not selfish love. And the difference between selfless love and selfish love is that selfish love is about I love to get what I can get out of it. That's an egocentric love. But in order to have love which is selfless and not selfish, love must come together with what we call respect. Respect for the individual. Not smothering the other person. Not overwhelming the other person. Not trying to dilute and conquer the other person or control the other person. But respecting the other person's individuality. We know that when a true relationship is one where they're two separate individuals. And we need to respect that. We need to give the space for another person. So we love. Love is connection. Love is attraction. Love is engagement. But we also need gevurah, which is holding back, self-control, giving space, the power to listen, the power never to humiliate, the power never to put down when they don't think like me or feel like me, and so on and so forth, right? And just for a moment, I'm going to pause, and I want to show you an amazing little, cute little thing. I'm going to share the screen just one more time. And have a look at this. You know, in Hebrew, respect, which is also like gevura, has another word also called yira, which is yira means like fear, but that doesn't mean fear. It means like holding back, giving respect for someone else. And of course, love is ahava. And in Hebrew, if you look at the word yira and ahava, look at this beautiful thing. Yira is yud resh aleph hey, yira, and ahava is aleph hey vet hey. And the two are intertwined. For there to be a good relationship, there needs to be love and respect. Every relationship needs love and respect. In fact, respect comes before love. The respect of another human being makes it possible to love them selflessly rather than selfishly. I'm not going to go into it in great length. We've done this before. And in fact, if you look at the formula, the way it works like this. You look at the word yira, this is the word yira. You look at the word ava. But if you read it a bit differently, you see how they intertwine. Look at the word yud resh, the letters yud resh, and then look at the first two letters of ahava, love, aleph hey. Take the top two letters on the top line and the bottom two letters here on the right, you get the word yira. If you take the last two letters of yira, which is aleph hey, and the last two letters of ahava, which is bet hey, you get the word ahava. Right? I hope you can see that. Okay. Now, what does that take? So they're intertwined. What does that take? It takes lack of ego, takes humility. Because selfish love comes when we are self-absorbed and we're in a relationship for self-gain and self-pleasure. And then we're unable to combine love and respect. But if we let go of our ego a little bit and we're in it to give and take, to learn and to grow from the other as well as they grow from us, and we're selfless, and of course we have love, but love is together with, it's not selfish love, it's selfless love, because it comes together with respect. That is, the source of that is the concept of humility. And just to finish this idea, just for those that are okay with Hebrew here, we know that in the Chumash, we find this is the antidote to ego. Because ego, we find a similar concept. There was one individual, in fact, we just learned about him in last week's parasha, called Bilam. Bilam was known as the prophet that was going to curse the Jewish people. And in the Ethics of the Fathers, it says that Bilam was the symbol of a haughty spirit. He was an egocentric person. We also have the famous nation of Amalek. Amalek was this anti-Semitic nation that attacked the Jewish people where they come out. But also, spiritually, it's a symbol of ego, a symbol of apathy, a symbol of what everything undermines a good relationship. And we have the same phenomenon with these two words, Bilam and Amalek. Bilam is Bet Lamed Ayin Mem Lamed Kuf. If you take the first two letters of Bilam, the first letters of Amalek, it makes Bilam. If you take the last two letters of Bilam and the last letters of Amalek, it makes Amalek. Same thing, intertwined. That's the symbol of ego, but the symbol of humility is the combination between Yira and Ahava, respect and love. Okay, so that's just a little Hebrew thing that I wanted to share. However, this is where, let's just summarize so far. So we have this concept of the guidance coming from the head, the foundation being's the ability to pause, to stand back, to reflect, to think things through, to understand what is a healthy relationship, what isn't a healthy relationship, to see the signs of a toxic relationship before we get into it. Once we're in a relationship, to know what are our goals? Are we ready for a relationship? Do we have the respectful nature? Can we respect? Can we love selflessly? Can we learn from the other? Can we go beyond ourselves? What are our values? What are our goals? All these things need to take place as a foundation and as a guidance for a healthy relationship. Then, of course, we need to go to the second room, which is the room of emotion, as we said, which is love, passion, respect, the combination of both, engaging but holding back, smothering with love but yet respecting the individuality of the other. All those things need to work together. Love in a way where there's complete respect, so there's never putting another person down, never humiliation, never trying to undermine the other person, and so on and so forth. By the way, not that there's never disagreements. There should be disagreements. For a relationship to thrive, there needs to be disagreements. This is between people, between communities, between parties, whatever the case is. As I said last night, those of you that were on the schmooze, we need to learn not to get on with each other. We need to learn not how to get on. We need to learn how to fight. We need to learn how to disagree. John Gottman, of course, has a tremendous lot of work on this. And he says this also, we need to know how to disagree. To disagree with respect, to disagree without undermining the other person, to listen, but yet to hold our own ground. All these things are part of the emotional part of a relationship and putting into practice. Then there's the third and the most important part of the relationship, and that is putting it to the test. That was the topic of tonight, really. And that is represented by that third area of the temple, the activity part, the outside. Because we might think things through really, really well, and we might build up an incredible emotional attachment in the most healthy and strong way. But often what happens to relationships is relationships are under threat by outside distractions. Similar to what happened in the temple where the main activity took place. Because the truth is, relationships don't happen in a cocoon. They don't happen in a vacuum. The relationships have to then work in the real world. And this is where the test needs to happen. To see how well we've done in the head and to see how well we've done in the heart is to see how well we can succeed when we put to the test. When the life pressures come on, when the outside world's pressures are real, when there's financial pressures, lockdown pressures, children pressures. Sometimes that's, I just heard recently someone told me a little story about three mothers that met in a restaurant, pre-lockdown, of course. And they sat down, and as Jewish mothers sometimes do, the one gave, like we call in Yiddish, a krech. She said, oi. And the other one said, oi. And the third one said, I thought we agreed that we're going to come out and have some fun and not talk about our children. Right? Sometimes children are a source of stress at different times. Young children, one type of stress. Older children, other types of stress. Not easy. Parenting in this world today is a tough thing. Sometimes there's even greater levels of stress. Greater levels of stress, which is sickness, tragedy, whatever the case is. And we know, looking around the world, that sometimes a relationship appears to be good and then it's put to the test by difficulty and stress and stressful situations on all levels. A little bit of stress, a lot of stress. And sometimes it has a very, very negative impact on the relationship. And that's where a relationship can either fall apart or can really thrive. You know what's interesting, going back to the model that we started with, the model of the temple, what happened outside in the courtyard? There was an altar, and I said most of the ritual activities that take place in that courtyard. And what used to take place there is what we call korbanot, which in English is sacrifices. Because we know, putting aside the philosophical understanding of the function of a korban, of a sacrifice, and what it was meant to do, and so on, and how we marry that up with modern thinking and all that. That's not for tonight's discussion, but there was a concept called korbanot, which is sacrifices. And in Hebrew, it's interesting. The word in English is called sacrifices, but in Hebrew, it's actually called a korban. The word korban in Hebrew comes from the word kiruv, to come close. So really, the word korban, or it can mean to offer up something, lahakriv, like a sacrifice. So the word korban actually has two meanings, closeness and sacrifice. And in fact, that is exactly the core principle behind relationships. In order to come close, we have to sacrifice, which means we have to give up a little bit of ourselves. We have to make room for the other. I've told the story in the past, there was a great Hasidic rabbi called the Tzemach Tzedek. Someone came to him and complained. Rabbi, he says, you know, whenever I go to the synagogue, everyone, figuratively speaking, everyone steps on me. So the Tzemach Tzedek told him, who told you to spread yourself out in the entire synagogue? One of the greatest powers of a relationship on all levels is not to take up all the space, which taking up all the space normally comes from an insecurity, which then manifests itself in an arrogance. Arrogance is a symptom of insecurity. It's the necessity, the obsessiveness of protecting my fragile self. But if we have an inner strength, if we know, if we are comfortable with ourselves and we understand ourselves and we know where we're going and we know our intrinsic value and we're very comfortable and okay with who we are, in, not who we are in terms of being complacent, but who we are in terms of our intrinsic value and potential, then there's plenty of room for other people. And that's the greatness of a relationship. And that's what brings people together. When people come together, it comes through making room for others. So the kiruv, the closeness, comes from the sacrifice. And we're willing to give up. We're willing to make room for the other. And it's not give up in a negative sense where I'm the one giving up. It's about us. It's about the relationship. I don't know if you remember, many of you watched the interview which my son and, my, and myself did with this couple in Israel, this amazing couple, where one became very Haredi religious and the other one remained totally secular and have this beautiful, beautiful marriage, complete conflict of values, but it's the most amazing marriage. And one of the most powerful things she said was, because someone asked her, you know, the other guy's religious, I mean, you have to make all these compromises. She said she made a choice when all this happened and it was very stressful in the beginning. But the turning point for her was that she made a choice that when she gives up things, it's not about sacrificing that she's giving in order to give to the other person. But she's nurturing the relationship. It's about the we, not about the I. It's about what's good for us as a relationship. And they both ended up compromising. And they both have this beautiful respect and sparkle. It's in the most amazing relationship. And it was the most powerful discussion. I'm sure many of you remember it, right? It was incredible. And it was all about, because in a relationship, we don't look at sacrifice as I have to give up and therefore we tally our points, who's giving up more. It's about what are we doing for us as a unit? Yes, we respect each other. We're going to listen to each other. We're doing for each other. We both make space, but it's about the readiness to give space. And today we live in a world where people are so self-protective. And of course, self-protection is the important thing. We talked about this last night, but we also need to have the art of going beyond ourselves, making space for others. And therefore, when threats happen to a relationship, when we're outside or when there's outside distractions and there's pressure and people are irritable and people are sort of losing their patience, it's a time to step back, a time to just say, hold on a second. Are we going to use this? Are we going to fight for our own individual survival? Or are we going to use the lockdown or the stress or the kids or the finance problems or whatever test is coming our way? Are we a unit and are we going to use this to grow together? Are we going to be in this together? Are we going to get through this together? Are we going to thrive through this together? And that's putting the relationship to a test, but that's when a relationship is really tested. And that's when we have to go back, when we're outside and we sometimes are a bit stressed out, and therefore because of that, our relationship becomes stressed. It's then when we have to just take a step back and go back to the Ark, go back to the Holy of Holies, go back to the Chesed and the Gevura, the love and the respect, and examine how strong are they, and re-examine our values and re-examine our goals and re-examine what we really want. Do we want to just be right? Do we want to just be stuck in ourselves? Or do we want happiness? Do we want true growth and true happiness, which comes through relationships? And then if we can't do it ourselves, that's a time to reach out and get support from other people. And that's why that's an incredibly important thing in a relationship, that when things aren't going so well, it's okay to reach out, it's okay to get help, it's okay to get support, right? That's okay, because sometimes things are tested. But it's that last application of relationship, the day-to-day pressures of life, where the relationship is put to a test, but the relationship also blossoms. It's there where the relationship really thrives, if we choose that it should thrive in that situation. And as I said, sometimes it means going back to our original, the first part of the temple, the second part of the temple, and then re-examining it and reapplying it to a most healthy sense. So that's just it was a sort of a thing I just decided a few days ago that to do this session, I thought, given the time of the Jewish calendar, it'd be good to sort of use this context, use this formula. And again, you know, so much to talk about, so many questions, of course, and so many details to iron out and to thrash out and to break down. But that's just a general concept of the structure relationship based on this mystical idea of the temple and the importance of using all three rooms, all three areas, important using the head and the thinking and the reflection, growing the emotions in a healthy way where there's a combination of both chesed and gevurah, love and respect, and also putting it to the test and making sure it works on a practical level. So we'll stop there and thanks for listening. And I'll unmute if anyone wants to say anything, but Have a good night and stay safe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Rabbi. Awesome.
That was great.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Rabbi. Talk about hold on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.